The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-oh! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn. Ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn. Tell people to stay off the lawn. Compare it to your neighbor's lawn. And complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.
Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.
If my pops finds out I got in trouble in school today, I'm definitely going to be on punishment. There's a party tonight at Peter's house. Can I go?
You're not going nowhere. Every little step you take will be around this bedroom tonight.
Did you hear anything about a party tonight?
At least not any good ones.
Hello, Tawatha. Do I feel like being bothered with Tawatha? Hello, LaDonna.
It's booming.
Yo, baby, looking real good.
Step off.
Scandalous. Kick it, Pop.
What you got to say now, punk?
How much more trouble can I get into?
Hey, eraser head.
Look, I'm in prison. Just do me a favor. Don't pick up the soap.
I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. We've created a new way to protect you from unpredictable interest rates. Our exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, we lock your interest rate for up to 90 days. Then, if rates go up, your rate stays locked. But if rates go down, your rate drops. Either way, you win. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year fixed-rate loans. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply.
Wait till I find him. I'm going to kill him.
Yo, y'all, look who fell into the gig.
Hey, this ain't Soul Train. The two finest women in here. Now, how could a man choose?
He better choose right.
Okay, so where would I wait to?
The house party.
What?
The house party.
Jay going to that damn party. That's all to it. I don't give a damn what you say.
You're going to make me a social misfit.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me once again is Mr. Patrick Bromley.
Hello, Mike. Thanks for having me back.
Also back at the booth this week is Mr. J. Scott Smith.
Gentlemen, it's good to be here.
This week, we're discussing the 1990 film from director-writer Reginald Hudlin, House Party, starring Christopher Reed and Christopher Martin, a.k.a. Kid and Play, the former backup dancers of Salt and Peppa, who became successes in their own rights. As the title might give away, this is a film about a house party and the wild shenanigans surrounding it. It's also a lot more than just that, and we'll be discussing the ins and outs of the film and the four other films that it inspired. So if you're afraid of spoilers, please beware. So, Jay, when was the first time you saw House Party, and what did you think?
The first time I saw House Party came out in 1990. I ended up seeing it on VHS at a friend's house the following year, in 1991. I was a little too young to have seen it in the theaters, but a friend of mine got a hold of it, and we watched it for the first time, and it was, I think the funny thing about seeing that movie then as opposed to kind of rewatching it now, and by the way, it's insane that 1990 is almost 30 years ago now, but to see that movie, it was like in that line of the movies that were coming out earlier in the 90s where you had the black comedy movies from the Wayans brothers and now you have House Party. What I thought the most about it was, I'm thinking, is this what it's going to be like when I'm in high school or when I'm in college? And it's a really cool, it's very 90s. I mean, I watched it again recently just to kind of get refreshed on it. It's startling how much things have changed. When I say that I really liked the movie the first time I saw it, it was super cool. Now it just gives me all sorts of nostalgia seeing it because it just takes me right back to where I was when I was 11 and 12 years old and watching the older kids who were going to house parties and having all kinds of fun and doing different stuff like that.
How about you, Patrick?
I honestly didn't see it until probably like the mid-2000s. I didn't catch it as a kid because I was just, I had a pop culture awareness of Kid and Play, but, you know, didn't really know their music because at that point my whole world was probably like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. So it wasn't until like the mid-2000s I had read this book called Why We Make Movies, which was a book of interviews and profiles on black filmmakers. And there was a whole thing about Reginald Hudlin and the way that House Party was spoken about. I was like, oh, maybe I really need to check this movie out. So I went and blind bought the DVD and watched it. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's House Party. That's fun. But yeah, very 90s. And I had a much different reaction to it this time. It was very interesting to watch it probably 10 or 15 years after that initial viewing, and I had a whole new appreciation for it.
So apparently I'm the old man of the group because I saw this one, I saw 1, 2, and 3 and Class Act all theatrically. And when I saw them, I was 18 when House Party 1 came out and absolutely loved it. I was a little familiar with Robin Harris. I was pretty familiar with Kid and Play, though I don't think I owned any of their albums. I remember liking a lot of Salt and Peppa, but again, I didn't have their albums. I was more into like Run DMC, so of course I saw Tougher Than Leather. I was more into Public Enemy, a little bit harder stuff than what Kid and Play were doing, but I always liked the look, and I loved Kid's funky, fresh, high-top fade that he had going on. And I love all the jokes about the hair in this movie. And again, going back to Robin Harris, I love Robin Harris. He is hilarious, and I absolutely love him in this movie. And it's always so sad for me to revisit this, and especially to revisit the second one, where there's so much pining for Robin Harris. And he just makes such a big impact on this film that I just can't overstate how great he is in this role, even though it doesn't have a lot to do, but he kind of makes his role his own with this.
He was a bridge. He was definitely a bridge. And I distinct when I'm rewatching, because Robin Harris is, he was always one of those great what ifs, because he was one of those really in a kind of like an ahead of his time. His timing of everything about him was so great, especially in this movie. It kind of summed up who he was, even down to the little details. Because there's a point in the first movie where he's walking up the street looking for his son, looking for Kid, and the police pull him over, and it's like he's grousing about having to find him. And even just a little detail of, he mentions, I never should have married that white woman, which instantly explains why his son, Kid, is that much of a different of a complexion from him. And I just found that just so humorous, is that he took a minute to note that detail. That little detail in there, just little things like that. Plus, he was just so ridiculously funny. Just incredibly, just really quick-witted. Some of his comedy would not go over at all very well today, but a lot of things in that movie are super problematic in 2019. But it was, watching it then and kind of being able to go back to that, it was, House Party was one of those portraits. If you wanted to know what hip hop culture was in 1989, 1990, watch House Party. Because that's what it was. It's like you mentioned, I think of, for me, House Party was also the dances. Because I was in fifth and sixth grade, and a lot of the kids are doing the Kid and Play dance and all the different routines, when we're just to that age, we're starting to kind of understand what rap was around us. I didn't really get super into rap till about 92, 93 when I was getting into high school. But it was it's such a coming of age point where we see the Kid and Play dance and all that other cool stuff. It was just amazing. And the number of people who have become future stars in that movie as well really jumped out to me too.
The thing where Play is vacuuming his house, and he's doing the dance while he's vacuuming the house. And when he tries to do that it was really the signature move of Kid and Play, where they would hold one leg, one ankle with one hand, and then jump through that angle. I mean, I had a couple friends in high school that could do that move, and it just completely floored me every time I would watch them do that. And then I love that he screws up that move and ends up tripping over the vacuum cleaner, which is great.
Because we've all done that at some point. We've all done that. If you were a young, especially a young black kid, in the early 1990s, everybody tried to do the kid and play thing at parties with friends. I did that. For me, it was with a broomstick, where I had a broomstick up against the wall, and I would try to keep doing the same step and make sure I was able to hang in there and still do it, because we were still doing the kid and play thing. And when we got to high school in the mid-90s, because people would just have fun because they would play Ain't Gonna Hurt Nobody or Rolling with Kid and Play, and you would start doing the dance. And it would be the coolest thing ever when you get two guys to be able to pull it off, which I pulled it off successfully in ninth grade at a ninth grade party in 1994. I was able to pull that. I was able to pull that move off. It's like now every time the more I think about it, it's like it's taking me back to when I was a teenager. It's really, really cool. But that was a cultural experience for us. And I don't think we realized it initially how much of a cultural experience it was for us.
So I read the screenplay for this, and the father character, though, going back to Robin Harris, was not Robin Harris in the screenplay. It was just a father character, and then all of the stuff that Harris brings to it and injecting in his own stand-up comedy. They basically just turn him loose at the house party once he arrives, and the thing of the kid with the Jerry curls, that's right out of his routine and stuff. And it's just like, wow, this is fantastic just to get those kind of, you know, you play to your strengths. You know, here we have this stand-up comic who's got this great timing. Let's just let him riff a little bit and we'll kind of work it into the screenplay.
He's really great at roasting dudes. You could see it because you could see some of the people in the background couldn't hold it. They were starting to laugh and starting to kind of, it was just like, it was perfect. I kept thinking to myself, what was that like? If they ever had any outtakes, what did the outtakes look like? How many people couldn't hold it when he just starts going after the guy for the Jerry curl and making fun of Belial? And Robin Harris, it's funny now to see it because Martin Lawrence was a young comic at this point, kind of a young up and comer. And Robin Harris is the seasoned vet out there just roasting guys and having a blast with it all. That was what really lunged out at me too. It looked like it was a blast to shoot that, and I can only imagine nowadays with all the outtakes and everything else, how great it would have been to have really been there to see how they handled him and how many other ad libs that he made when he was going after different people.
My understanding too, and I don't know how much of this is just rumor and how much of this is actually true, that the Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince version sort of came about because they owed New Line because they were sued for sampling part of the Nightmare on Elm Street music for Nightmare on My Street, and that was sort of why they were going to do this movie, was because New Line sort of held this over their heads, but that Reginald Hudlin was not interested in forcing these two young men to make the movie with him, so he decided to go with Kid and Play instead.
And I will say, Kid and Play, they have a lot of charisma, and watching these two guys through the three house party movies and Class Act, they hold it together. They really can do a great job. And I like the way that they set these two characters up as being, you know, kind of the dorky good guy. I mean, they really play it up in Class Act, but as far as like the dorky good guy and the kind of conniving, scheming, not necessarily bad guy. I mean, Play is not bad, but he's not really a good friend. And a lot of times he ends up being Kid's nemesis, whether he intends to or not. But I have to say, they have the charisma, they have the chops. It doesn't feel like, oh, we're just going to take these two dancer rapper guys and throw them in here, and then good luck with that. They can hold their own with every single actor in this film.
They were nuanced characters, and there were the little elements of it. You see it when he goes off on Play, when he talked about not having the condom ready, and they were razzing him about that. He gets pissed off. He says, but you're a dog though, and talks about the way he treats women and how very clearly they disagreed about that whole thing, or how they had the rap battle in the house party and they were at each other. And it was interesting kind of seeing that dynamic that they were friends, but they weren't, they had little enemy moments at the same time, or they had disagreements where it showed there were actual layers and levels to their partnership.
And also the whole idea of Play really being kind of addicted to Belial as well. And this whole idea of him, I mean, my God, I just cringe every time they have that scene where he's throwing Belial's DJ gear into his car and just scratching the sides of the towers and stuff. Oh, man, does that ever hurt?
That hurts.
And the way that he's just throwing those records in and stuff. And yeah, I mean, really, we kind of start the beginning of the second act of this film with Belial sitting there on the porch and just like, nope, I'm not going with you. There's no way, you know, you'd really treat me bad. You know, I shouldn't be playing at a friend's house for free. You know, just that's, I'm getting no respect from that. And eventually, you know, I mean, the lure of young, nubile flesh is, you know, the downfall for almost everyone in this movie, and eventually gets him in there. And then even when they're driving to the house party, which seems like it must be quite a few blocks away, they see Kid running away from full force, and he's like, was that Kid? Oh, yeah, whatever. I don't have room in my car anyway. It's just like, man, what a dick move this guy's doing. And I have to say, I really like that we have these two very well-drawn female characters in here between Shireen and Sydney, and that they are, I would say, almost as important to the narrative as Kid and Play, and there's so much time spent with them. I don't think they pass the Bechdel test by any means, because they're always talking about Kid and or Play, but that they can have conversations and that we see them away from Kid and Play. They actually exist in this universe without needing to be around male characters.
They could have carried their own film, almost like a spinoff of some sort, because there was a story there with them. And it was there was a good story arc with them, where there's the level of insecurity that Sydney has because she feels like she's not as outgoing and she has a bit more of a conscience than Sherelle has, where Sherelle just basically says she's living for the moment, essentially. And she doesn't care if she's messing around with two guys who are obviously friends, whereas Tisha Campbell has more of the nuance of saying, no, this isn't right, this isn't right. But at the same time, when she gets with Kid, and it's like, there's something there that it's like when you first see House Party, you say, oh, this is a cool, fun little movie. But yeah, there are certain elements to it that really keep it together very, very well. And that's one of them, is the relationship between those two friends, where it's similar to that of Kid and Play. It's almost like they're kind of the female equivalent of them.
And that's one of the reasons why in 2019 I'm still interested in talking about this movie, is that it wasn't just this throwaway piece of pop culture where no one mattered at all to the story and we can just forget about it 5 minutes later, where some of these jokes from the first movie and the third movie can stick with me for all these years and I can still quote them, I can still talk about them, still think about them, and they still have relevancy in this age.
Oh, and it makes it such a fun kind of a hangout movie too, because that's, you know, that's for me, that's what makes a good hangout movie, is I can drop in on any of the characters at any point during the movie and I'm engaged and I'm interested, and it's not like, oh my gosh, please get back to Kid and Play already. It would have been so easy to just make this movie the Kid and Play vehicle, you know, the From Justin to Kelly of its day. And instead they like, or the, you know, Cool as Ice or whatever garbage movie you want to talk about. But like, no, Reginald Hudlin made a real movie, a good movie that just happens to star, you know, Kid and Play, who honestly, as I'm watching it, Mike, you had said earlier how charismatic they are. Yeah. At no point do I watch it feeling like, oh, these guys are hip hop artists. These guys are musicians who are trying to act. They feel completely natural. I never remember that, like, oh, acting was not their first strength. You know, it's just a good movie that just happens to star these two musicians, but then they're surrounded by these interesting characters or really funny characters. You know, we drop in on Robin Harris and we're laughing. We go back to Tisha Campbell and we're sort of invested in her story. We go back to Martin Lawrence and I don't know, you know, no matter who we drop in on, it's cool.
Well, I will admit something that I should probably be ashamed of, but I'm not for whatever reason. I wasn't aware of Full Force as being a group at this time. It took me a lot of years before I realized who our three main villains are in this movie, that they are members of Full Force. And I think it was, what, three brothers and three cousins or something? It was a pretty big group.
Yeah.
And that's the song that they dance to when they're having their dance off, is Ain't My Type of Hype, which is a Full Force song. I had no idea, because I bought that these three guys were actors. I never would have thought that they were primarily, you know, rappers, producers first and actors second, because I love the chemistry that they have, and especially, you know, Pee Wee with his whole,
if I was you, I'd kick his fucking ass.
they're super clownish, but I don't think they pass from clownish into more of like a minstrel territory. They're not like overly drawn characters, you know, like just walking stereotypes. Like Stab, I mean, the guy's name is Stab, is a muscle head and he's just a font of rage, but I don't think that, I think there's more to him than just that.
It was interesting because they were your, and I use this term very, very carefully. They were your typical early 90s black hip hop film characters. They fit the, they almost like they set the bar for the villain in a lot of these movies where they almost like the Pee Wee being very Chris Rockish in yes. the way he speaks and the Full Force thing. When I saw them, here's the fun part. When I first saw the movie, I didn't think of them as Full Force either. I'd heard of them and I'd heard their music, but it didn't register with me until I watched it again when I was in college. It's like, oh shit, that's right. That's Full Force. So the group trying to get into the party, their music is already playing in the party. And these are guys who've had, because Full Force, outside of just being, they were just they were more than just an R&B group at the time. They did hip hop. They produced music across all different genres of music. Not many groups can say that they produced music for UTFO, Patti LaBelle, and NSYNC in their career. They did so much. But in a way, their characters in the movie kind of fit who they are. You know them, but you don't know who they are until you look back at it. And I love the element that they added because even in the midst of them being these heels, these bad guys, where they're constantly just all over the movie trying to get Kid, it's almost like the Wile E. Coyote routine of trying to chase down the Roadrunner. There was still a little bit of extra to them. There was that moment where they're saying, dude, you're going too far. Or I'm not here for burning down somebody's house. Or when
that is still crazy. When they still go to burn down the guy's house, I'm like, oh my God.
Even he says, wait, I'm not trying to do all that. Or he has the half moment when they're in jail and Kid tries to talk him into just saying, hey, can we just squash this and figure our way out of this? And he thinks for a second before basically telling him to F off. There was a lot of character development in a movie like this that when you see it at 11 and 12 years old, you don't get it. But then you watch it again in your 20s. It's like, wow, this is cool. And I see it it's still crazy. Almost 30 years later. And there's so much there that this was a really great piece. This was actually a really great piece. Plus, it was just funny. It's amazing how you're able to make that work. The best can make things like that work.
I like the callbacks in this movie, too. I mean, Robin Harris obviously being informed by a lot of Dolemite's work, and then him talking about like, oh, I rented Dolemite, and that you hear Dolemite on the TV when Kid's trying to sneak out and stuff. I mean, I love that. And when Robin Harris starts doing the Dolemite, the signifying monkey rap and stuff, I mean, that is just fantastic. And then the use of George Clinton in here as well, which again, he wasn't in the screenplay. They just had like old DJ and the whole thing of him, it was more Kid was scratching the records and all this, but I like that they used George Clinton for that and that you hear Parliament Funkadelic in the background during that scene and everything. That's really nice. And again, it's kind of a nice throwback to like, yeah, we see our elders and we're moving on from that kind of stuff. We're taking what they're doing and building on that, which is a nice way of approaching this stuff. And it didn't feel like stunt casting or anything where it's just like, you know, if you knew who George Clinton was, cool. And otherwise, I like that he's miserable there with the older people. And that one woman, when Kid says, raise your hand in the air and wave them if you just don't care. I love that one woman who has that crazy look on her face when she brings up her hands and is just moving them like almost like a robot or something. Still hilarious to me.
It was interesting when you see, when I think back to hip hop in the early 90s, late 80s, there was a level of respect to the pioneers because a lot of hip hop is drawn from funk music. And George Clinton had a huge influence on a lot of rappers, especially because you go later in the decade with like Ice Cube and Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre, and that a lot of that was influenced by guys like George Clinton. So that's actually a great nod to have him in a movie like this, because there was a way of them kind of bridging the generations and kind of saying, hey, there is respect shown and respect due here. And it was also a really funny scene. As soon as I see him pop up, and I just broke out laughing. It's like, oh my God, that's George Clinton again. It's just the first thing I think of is that they got him in there, and a much more toned down George Clinton from what we see today, where it takes you a second to figure it out, but then you realize, like, wait, that is George Clinton, just without the crazy colored dreads and the big fur coats and everything. But he was too cool for the party back in 1990. And he's still too cool for the party now, even all this time later.
Well, I will admit I had kind of a blind spot when it came to a lot of Parliament Funkadelic stuff. And then I was a big fan of De La Soul. And when I heard the song that basically was Me, Myself, and I was like, oh shit, this is almost exactly that song, just with like an added drum beat to it. I mean, it's just amazing how much of Parliament Funkadelic stuff was bitten by those early rappers and by all the sampling that was going on. It was just fantastic.
It's even more interesting if you look at the, because I'm big on album covers, if you look at the album covers for some of Parliament Funkadelic stuff, and then you look at some of De La Soul's, like 3 Feet High and Rising, you look at some of the designs, their album covers look almost exactly like Parliament Funkadelic's too. They steal little elements. Well, I won't even say steal. They borrow elements from that as just little nods along the way. And it was interesting because at that time, hip-hop culture was still kind of really burgeoning. I mean, rap had been around for about 15 years to get to 1990, but it wasn't until 90, 91, 92, 93 where hip-hop becomes more of a phenomenon in the country. But there were still always the little nods back to the funk and the 80s R&B that a lot of this stuff got pulled from. And Parliament Funkadelic was just, for one, it was just a great, they're always going to be a great, they're timeless. They're a timeless group. But when you see that, you realize how much of an impact they had on that generation of rap, because there were so many nods to them that it was almost kind of comical when the way that they were doing it.
I mentioned that Jerry Curl character earlier, who doesn't show up at all other than that one moment. I was like looking for him in the background because he ends up being one of the ex-cons from X-Con Catering. And I love that he just is basically there just for one joke. And even with, like, you talked about Martin Lawrence, and Martin Lawrence, his one defining character trait is his bad breath. But again, it's not just one joke. Was very interesting in the way that the party is the whole second act of the film. Like, there's a little bit of it, I think, in the third act, but really the second act of this movie is the house party proper. And it's a nice way to frame this thing. We've got the beginning where it's like, can I go to the party? All the conflict about that. I like that we don't have to worry about the parents coming home, even though there is some talk about, you know, the toilet being broken and, you know, play kicking out everybody from the party towards the end there. But then that third act where we have kid going to jail, his rather uncomfortable rap about, let's say it's uncomfortable about getting raped in prison. that one doesn't age too well.
That didn't age well at all. That didn't age well after 10 years, after 30.
Wow. Yeah, that was rough. But yeah, him getting with Sydney and the whole thing with the condom and the discussion about why you would want to get with Sydney versus why you want to get with Shireen, and the whole idea of the Shireen living in the projects and having privacy, having moments to yourself that plays, I guess he's okay with that because he seems to be more interested. I mean, I always talk about how at the end of too many movies, you have to have the coupling. And in this, there's the idea of who's going to go with who. Is it going to be Sydney and kid? Is it going to be Shireen and play? That's how it ends up being. But there is some tension as far as how that's going to be. I mean, it seems natural at the end of the day that, you know, the more street smart, I guess, is how you would call play, the more brazen one is going to go with Shireen, because Shireen seems to have that bigger personality. She seems like she would need somebody like play to be with, and maybe they could kind of keep each other in check as far as that go. And Sydney's the nice girl who's and this is interesting that her parents are some of the people that are at this more upscale party earlier in the film, the one that George Clinton is DJing at. And I think they said, isn't her father a doctor or something?
I think so, yeah.
It seems like there would be more of an economic difference between kid with his dad who's looking for overtime work versus Shireen who seems very affluent, but they seem to get along pretty well.
I really like, too, that whole sequence where Kid and Tisha Campbell are sort of getting to know one another, and then it leads into the condom stuff. And, you know, you can get away with some of the movie is like a little harder edged than I remember, because I think in my brain, this is like, oh, it's this PG-13 movie, you know, and then I watch it. I'm like, oh God, no, this is pretty R rated. This is very R rated. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in here but I really like their dynamic. And I think you can get away with so much of the raunchier stuff because I think there's something that's very, very sweet at the core of their relationship and that exchange that they have, where he says, you know, if I have to pick, you're the one I want to be friends with. And she's kind of disappointed for a second. And then he says, I think if you're going to, you know, be with someone, you should be friends and lovers. And I just think that line allows them to get away with so much more because it's not just some movie about these sexed up teenagers, that they have actual thoughts and feelings and that they actually genuinely are capable of caring about one another. And that to me makes such a difference when it comes to the coupling up stuff, that it's not just this perfunctory, like, well, by the end of the movie, they have to be paired up, that it takes the time to say, oh, these young people have actually formed a connection and actually like one another. That goes such a long way with me.
It's almost like I had to remind myself that they were supposed to be high school students. It's like I had to keep saying this. They almost seemed like they would be college students because these are very mature. They were very mature teenagers, to put it mildly. But at the same time, with the sneaking in and out of the houses, it's like, yeah, I guess they're supposed to be in high school. But again, very, very nuanced. There was actual depth to some of them. And yeah, you had the same kind of same reaction I did, where I thought I was remembered it as being a little less raunchy version. But no, this thing came at you pretty quick. As soon as I'm going to kick his fucking ass, like, oh yeah, this is this was not PG-13 at all. But if you have Robin Harris, it makes sense. But this was not PG-13 in the least. But it was kind of a shock to the system. But seeing some of the characters with their different edges, that's what made it a surprisingly better movie than it may have seemed at the time, is because there was a lot of depth to it. It wasn't just comedy and pratfalls for the sake of pratfalls. There'd be nothing against the Wayans movies. I love those, but it wasn't like some of the Wayans movies that are very slapstick. This one actually had some depth to it.
And I like that even though Full Force, yeah, they're pretty bad dudes in this, and especially like when Stab crosses the line and wants to burn down Play's house, that's a whole other level. But the real bad guys in this movie end up being the cops, which is a nice thing too. And the way that they harass Robin Harris and they harass Kid, and the way that they make them say, I want to be somebody to them. And I like how the people at the party are kind of offended by that. I was just like, or I am somebody. That's a nice moment when the people at the party are just like, come on, you're really crossing the line here with this stuff. And that they get their comeuppance at the end by having the roof that we saw blown off the house, which I thought was in Kid's dream, but this dream roof come down and smash them at the end. It's really kind of a nice fuck you to the police.
It was one of those things where you could see it was building toward them getting their comeuppance along the way, where they're intentionally just screwing with anybody who happens to be walking up the street. And I can still remember Robin Harris saying that I was born in a town called out of cop's ass, and I feel like making a return. I'm watching that, and I'm just thinking, like, yeah. And the sad thing is, it's very timely. Unfortunately, it's kind of timely even now. So that was one of the things that unfortunately did kind of age a little well, was seeing that in the movie and seeing the police being the baddest of the bad guys along the way, where even as the scene at the party was very telling, where these older black people were there. It's almost like you have that moment where it gets very real very quickly. It wasn't heavy handed, but it was just one of those things. You look at that and almost like you put a push pin in it for later on down the line that one of them is going to get theirs, because it did go over the line. But that was also what some black youth were dealing with at the time from the police, is being humiliated like that, being picked on like that. So that was a nice touch to add to the movie. And yeah, having them get killed Wizard of Oz style at the end of it is pretty damn funny too.
Well, I remember a few years ago, there was a lot of stuff in the news about, you know, police being unfair to black youths, and there was a lot of violence, some killings, those kind of things. But I don't hear about that at all in the media these days, so I imagine that's all fine now,
it's all,
correct?
It's all cleared up.
That ended
at least 15 years ago. We have to worry about that now.
Wow. All right. That's good. All right, we're going to take a break and play an interview with the writer-director of House Party, Reginald Hudlin, and we'll be back with that right after these brief messages.
Hey, y'all, I got a great new album in the mail today.
Close your eyes.
Onyx Communications and Hey Love Productions proud to present Hey Love, the classic sounds of sexy soul. The Moments. The Stylistics, the incomparable Delphonics, and much, much more. You get 40 of the greatest soul ballads ever recorded.
Between love and you stay.
Not sold in any store, this exclusive TV offer is available only here, only now. Write this toll-free number down and call now to order this timeless soul treasure, taken from original masters. The Shy Lights. Barbara Mason. The immortal Linda Jones, and 20 more unforgettable soul classics.
Going in circles.
Remember, this limited offer is not available in any store. Operators are standing by. Order now before the sounds of sexy soul get away.
This is a fantastic album, man. Let me borrow it.
No, my brother. You've got to buy your own.
To order your copy of this classic collection, have your credit card ready and call 1-800-327-8300. That's 1-800-327-8300. Or rush $19.98 plus $4 shipping and handling to Hey Love, CS Box 3160, Department X, Melville, New York. Operators are standing by. Call 1-800-327-8300. Satisfaction guaranteed. Order now.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
I'm Dave Hunt, and I'm one of the co-hosts for Super True Stories, a podcast where two guys suffer through and report back on some of the worst documentaries you can stream for free.
And I'm Axel Kohagen, the other co-host. Film is a beautiful lie that teaches us about who we are on the inside. Dave and I look at the documentaries that are the ugliest of truths, teaching you about mixed martial arts and fishing, poorly faked ghost stories, and everything you wanted to know about poor production values and stock footage.
Check us out on iTunes, Google Play, or at supertruestories.com.
Hello from Cinema Detroit. We are Metro Detroit's only truly independent cinema, and also the only first-run, 7-day-a-week movie theater in greater downtown. We deliver an eclectic mix of mainstream, art, indie, genre, cult, and classic movies in the heart of the city. Like a sommelier choosing wine or a DJ mixing a set, we handpick our slate of films, many of which are exclusive to the metro area, the state of Michigan, or the entire Midwest region. Cinema Detroit features a unique setting in a former furniture store and a warm neighborhood atmosphere, including always fresh popcorn, Detroit-made Faygo soda, and other locally created treats. Please visit our website, cinemadetroit.org, for the latest features and showtimes. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram. We look forward to seeing you soon at 4126 3rd Street in the city, 48201.
Hi, this is Andrew from We Hate Movies, and you're listening to The Projection Booth. If you feel like laughing after listening to some serious film discussion, head on over to our show, WHMPodcast.com. Every Tuesday, a new episode drops, us ragging on bad movies, whereas the good folks here at The Projection Booth are talking about good party cinema-related stuff. Go here for the cinema, come to us for the laughs afterwards. We Hate Movies, every Tuesday.
What got you interested in becoming part of the entertainment business?
It was perfect timing. On one hand, you had this explosion of the blaxploitation era, right? Where you had Shaft, Superfly, all these movies. And at the same time, my brother, Warrington, went to Yale, which couldn't be more different from our hometown, East St. Louis, and discovered independent cinema and decided he wanted to be what was then called an underground filmmaker. So I saw these two very different paths to be able to make your own movies.
Were you a big fan of blaxploitation growing up, or did you tend to enjoy the underground cinema more?
I loved it all. I loved seeing empowered black heroes putting foot to ass, and at the same time, I was loving movies by Kurosawa and Ozu and learning about Frederick Wiseman and, you know, all this other stuff. So to me, it wasn't an either or. It was all the above.
How did you decide to pursue that? Did you go to your brother and say, this is what I want to do, now help me do it? Or did you kind of forge your own way?
I went to Harvard and I joined their film program. And by senior year, I had to make my own thesis film. So I worked that summer, saved up some money, and got some money from my brother, and wrote a script, which became a 20-minute short film called House Party.
Now, I haven't seen the short version of House Party, and I'm curious, what is it like? What happens in it?
It's kind of the same movie, but 20 minutes long. It starts with a kid being told he can't go to a party. He goes to a party, he meets a girl, and when he comes home, tries to sneak back in the house, his father catches him. So the fundamental beats, the structure of the feature are all there seated in the short film.
Well, how do you go from the thesis film to actually making the feature version of it?
Well, that wasn't originally the plan. House Party was... I mean, it was sort of the beginning of hip hop, and I loved hip hop music. I loved the excitement of it as this kind of new folk music that was being made as this great response to the disco movement, which was felt very oppressive and very corporate. But my goal was to make my version of Battle of Algiers some big political tract, and you know, it kind of made you know. But when you say okay. Well, if you're going to make a movie independently with very little money, you say, okay, well, what's a movie we can make really cheaply? So I figured in the worst possible case, I knew I could make House Party out of my pocket because it was just a simple movie. You know, I didn't need big stars. I could just do it with some kids in a few locations. So it seemed like a very doable film.
So after you graduate with that in hand, what happens next? Like, how do you go from that into making music videos? And I have to ask about the Hey Love commercial.
The Hey Love commercial was a job that got offered to my brother, some guys he knew. I didn't know exactly how. And there just weren't that many black people who were producing and directing anything. So they hired him to do the commercial, and I was there as a young kid helping out. I can't remember if the line, "No, my brother, you got to get your own," that may have been my idea, may not. I can't really remember, honestly. So that became sort of a legendary commercial. Then when a couple of my short films were shown at the Newark Film Festival, which I think is the oldest long-running black film festival, I met Andre Harrell. Andre Harrell was a protege of Russell Simmons, and he was starting his own label at Universal called Uptown. Through him, he saw the Strutt film, said, "You're talented, we're going to make movies together." And I was skeptical about whether the movie thing was going to happen, but I figured I could get some music video jobs. And in fact, my brother and I did the first two music videos for Uptown Records.
Now, I remember on Uptown, what, Heavy D, was he on that?
Yeah, we did Heavy D and the Boys, Mr. Big Stuff. And then there was sort of a company record called Uptown's Kicking It that featured verses from all the artists on the label. So we did two videos for $50,000 total, which seemed like a lot of money back then. And that was our kind of break into, show business.
Yeah, I've talked to actually quite a few directors who got their start in music video, but there's also a ton of directors who just stayed in music videos and just stayed there until that market ran dry. How did you make that transition from music video into feature film?
It's really about writing. I was writing scripts. It's not like whether it's then or now, there's not some huge amount of great screenplays sitting around about black culture. So if those are the kind of things you want to make movies about, you've got to generate it yourself.
So what were some of those screenplays that you're working on? I mean, were those, I imagine a few of them eventually you got to make, but what were some of the other ones that you're working on?
Well, House Party, obviously, there's a few other things that never got made. But the big break, actually, even before House Party, was from George Jackson, who was a black guy who graduated from Harvard a few years ahead of me. He knew about my short film, and he recommended me for my first Hollywood job, which was to develop a movie for Janet Jackson and The Time. Janet Jackson was hot, coming off the Control album. The Time had just done Purple Rain. So, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, the producers, had to deal with A&M Records. So it all kind of came together with that opportunity.
You just blew my mind. I can't imagine. I love Morris Day and Morris Day in a feature film. I mean, he was fantastic in Purple Rain. I can't imagine a more of a Morris Day vehicle. That would be fantastic.
I had never written a screenplay before, so I was really blessed to get paid to learn the job. I didn't know three-act structure. I don't think all the term papers I had ever written added up to 120 pages. So I just wrote and wrote and wrote and ended up turning in a 150-page script, which is way too long. And the executive there, Dale Pollack, who went on to write Skywalking, kind of one of the definitive books about George Lucas, he really was very patient with me and helped guide me to beating the script into some kind of shape. The movie ended up not happening, but I earned enough money to make a large purchase. So I could buy a car or a computer. And it figured a car depreciates, but if I bought a computer, I could write more scripts and I'd make more money. So I bought the computer.
So I imagine that the version of House Party that you wrote, even the feature version, probably changed a ton based upon the casting. And I'm curious, one, when it got greenlit, and two, when Kid and Play were introduced to the mix.
I had written the script. There was a junior executive at New Line named Helena Etchegoyen who introduced it to her boss. They loved the script. They liked the short film. So they said, "Hey, let's develop this." So they gave me a bunch of notes. I didn't agree with the notes, but they made me think about how to improve the script. So I worked on the script. And again, I had been planning on doing it using some of the stars from Uptown Records. Groove D. Chill, which is one of the acts, these guys were funny, they were smart, they were just great guys. So I planned on using them, and they said, no, we need bigger stalls than that. So I was on Video Music Box, which was sort of one of the few venues where you could see black music videos on television, would play Kid and Play videos. And I thought they were great. They were very visual. They had great dance moves. And I knew this girl who worked for their management company. They said they're very responsible. So I pitched Kid and Play. I may have overstated how many gold platinum records they had, but New Life bought into them. We made the movie with them. Now, there's a funny little anecdote there. There was a brief moment where New Life said, well, you know, we sued this other rap group for infringement on Nightmare on Elm Street. So, in the settlement deal, they're obligated to do a movie for us. So would you do a movie with Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince? And I said, sure, they're awesome. I just think that I want them to want to make the movie. To do a performance based on losing a lawsuit might be a little lackluster. So I went to Russell Simmons and I told him about the movie. Russell was very dismissive. Oh no, they've got some big movie about summer camp they're doing with John Peters, and they don't have time for your little movie. So I got blown off. We did the movie with Kid and Play.
So how does the project change when Kid and Play come to town?
Not that much, really. Their personalities really fit with the script that was written. The main thing was making sure that you build in musical and dance performances. And I love musicals, so doing a quasi-musical really appealed to me.
One of the standout scenes for me is the dance-off in the movie. That is such a fantastic scene to see those guys and then see the actresses also just really throw down.
Yeah. Well, Tisa and AJ were dancers and choreographers, so it was a natural pairing to have those two pairs face off with each other. And I really have to say, to this day, shooting that scene was one of the happiest days of my life. It was so much fun, so much joy. It was really intoxicating.
Now, I imagine that the house itself, that had to be a set.
Yeah, it was a set. The exterior was a real house in South Central, one of those beautiful craftsman homes, but the interior was a set at Culver Studios, which is the lot where they shot Girl with the Wind.
I can't even imagine how many days people had to be there dancing, quote unquote, because I imagine you shot a lot of it without any music whatsoever.
Well, what we would have is we'd start with some music and then we would click the music off and have the click track. So they caught the groove and then they would have to maintain the beat while we shot the dialogue for the scene.
I imagine that the folks that you had worked with before in your student film, maybe actors in your videos, not necessarily professional actors, but here you are dealing with more of a professional crew. What was that like for you making that transition?
Well, the crew was definitely professional, and that was a real step up. You know, being so young and making a movie, I felt that I had to command respect by being prepared, you know, having answers to questions. I remember the first day, there was a scene inside Shireen's house, right, in the projects. And her big brother was this wonderful actor that we saw on the beach the week before. We're like, hey, you're in L.A.? Yeah, I'm in L.A. Hey, welcome to be in our movie. So he was there. He was shirtless, and he was on the phone. But he was a background element while the conversation was going to happen in the front. So we were like, well, how do we do? So I said, well, just turn around so we don't see your mouth. And I remember the guys in the crew going, And it was like I passed a test I didn't know I was taking. The crew was like, oh, he actually can solve problems. That means this thing won't be a disaster. So it was a wonderful moment.
I don't want you to put words in your brother's mouth, but how was it for him working on this as well? Because this is definitely a far cry from kind of the underground film scene that I think that you were saying that he enjoyed.
Yeah, but we always knew the importance of making subversive cinema. And you know, it's not about making some preachy tract that's only speaking to the converted. The movie was a celebration of, you know, again, this is before hip hop kind of became the corporate behemoth that it is right now. It was still this really kind of resistance youth movement. And the secret message of the movie, which is safe sex, that was very subtly done. So the kids didn't feel like it was an after school special, but the message was there and was received. In fact, a year later, we got this award from this health clinic in New Jersey for encouraging kids to use safe sex. So I remember being there at the award ceremony and talking to the doctor who ran the clinic. And I said, this is really wonderful, but come on, I don't think the movie really made that much of a difference. And he says, you're completely wrong, Reggie. Kids come into the clinic and they reference your movie when they talk about, you know, practicing safe sex. And it blew my mind because, you know, you do these things with good intentions, but it doesn't mean it's going to work. So the fact that it actually did work was pretty amazing.
So what was it like working with Kid and Play? Like I said, they weren't necessarily professional actors, but they do a fantastic job.
Yeah, I mean, they were just great. I mean, they had to audition for me and then audition for the head of the studio. And I've always felt that rappers are more predisposed to have an easier transition into acting because in hip hop, you create a persona, you tell a story. Most of them, at least back then, wrote their own rhymes. So they were kind of auteurs in their own medium. So that transition is a little easier. And Kid and Play were absolute natural. They were wonderful actors and a joy to work with, as was Full Force, who played the bullies. And, you know, we're still all very close to this day. I mean, it was just a perfect collection of enormously talented people.
This is one of Martin Lawrence's first roles, correct?
Yeah. He had a tiny, tiny little part in Do the Right Thing. I think that may be his first movie, but I'm pretty sure this was his second.
Obviously, he comes from more of a stand-up background. I'm curious, was he allowed to ad-lib a little bit on this, or did he follow the script pretty much?
I allowed everybody to ad-lib. I mean, my thing was, you know, we had a lot of rehearsals. We incorporated their ideas in the rehearsals. And my rule is pitch anything you want. I'll hear you out. And if I say no, it means no. And that felt very good and fair to everybody because, you know, you can't have anarchy, but you don't want to stifle talented people. So Martin, who ironically enough worked at Sears with Salt and Pepper, who, you know, had the same producers and were friends with Kid and Play. So, I mean, it was a sort of a family atmosphere that was just there naturally. And Martin was brilliant and so much fun to work with. And there was just no doubt that his rise to stardom was inevitable.
I have to ask you about Robin Harris because obviously, you know, with you producing and writing Bebe's Kids and everything, I'm curious when you first met him and what it was like working with him.
We saw Robin at the Comedy Act Theater, and he was brilliant. I mean, he felt like this comedian from some other era that he had been thawed out of the ice and brought to life. When we first said we wanted to cast him, we were told, oh, you can't cast him because no one can understand him when he talks. And that, we're like, oh, then we're definitely going to cast him. I mean, if he's just so raw and so, you know, black that people don't understand him, then we understand him perfectly. So we put him in the movie, and he was just genius. And, you know, we were absolutely wanted him to be in everything we did. And our next movie was going to be Bebe's Kids as a live-action movie. But then when he passed away, I said, you know what? We can't let the memory of Robin Harris pass. So I turned the movie into an animated movie so that folks, he would still get to star in one last film.
I always wondered how you guys pulled that off as far as like when that came out, I was like, didn't he pass away a few years ago?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I'm really grateful to Faison Love, who, you know, back then was just starting out. And Faison could do a perfect, I mean, perfect imitation of Robin Harris.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was uncanny. It sounded like you guys had recorded that before he had passed away.
Right.
I really appreciate how much weight you gave to the Sydney and Shireen characters as well. So it wasn't just a kid in play. It wasn't just Chris and Peter, but it was so much their story as well. It was really a nice balance.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's just how I was raised, that, you know, women aren't just props, you know, you have a better movie when they're fully fleshed out characters. And, you know, working with Tisha and AJ, who were so talented and so funny, you wanted to build them out. And, you know, them as characters for Kid and Play to bounce off of, to make it, you know, a real, you know, real couples, real relationships, just made it a richer film and better for the male characters, as well as giving a variety of female characters to relate to. So, I mean, the Bechdel test, I don't think existed back then, but that was certainly, the goal was to create, make sure that, you know, all the characters of all genders were meaningful.
Yeah, this is your first feature film, and I'm curious, what were some of your biggest challenges on it?
Well, that was the scary part, because we didn't know what we were doing, right? You never made a movie before. But it was going so well that the fear was, are you missing something hugely important? Because it was a really fun, seamless production. But time, you know, we're shooting in summertime, and a lot of the movie took place at night, but we would have less than 8 hours of night to shoot stuff. So I remember the scene when my brother and I are doing a cameo, and we're running down the street from these attack dogs, and we jump on the bus, and the sun was rising. So we're like, oh, we can't shoot in that direction. It's dawn. I said, turn the bus around, drive in the other direction. It's still dark. And we got the shot.
And I'm so glad that the Hey Love commercial makes a cameo appearance.
You know, we just knew people would laugh. We were just shameless. Like, what did it take to entertain people? So we put Hey Love commercial in there. We put Dolomite in there. We just wanted to put all the flavors in there.
And it's such a nice nod, too, because it feels like Robin Harris is, like you said, like unfrozen from that age. It feels like he's kind of carrying on that mantle.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, like, you know, Robin's piccolo player joke. For me, I just going, oh my God, is this a joke in this era? I mean, like, it feels like something Red Fox would have said on the Chitlin' Circuit 30 years prior. But it was as funny now as it, you know, as anything.
When the movie's ready, were there any problems or any challenges as far as marketing this to a mainstream audience? I mean, because this played everywhere. I remember playing, you know, out in the suburbs where I was working at the time.
Mm-hmm. There was definitely challenges because the perception. I mean, I remember the Siskel and Ebert review, where Roger Ebert loved the movie, but Siskel hated it and thought it was about juvenile delinquents and, you know, who were, I mean, it wasn't even about the movie. He just hated the culture that the movie came out of. He kept complaining about graffiti, and it was just like, wow, that is the corniest response ever. So I remember that. And I remember there was a theater in Colorado who wouldn't turn the lights off entirely in the theater.
Oh, Jesus.
Because they thought riots would break out. So yeah, it was that time where, you just go, are you serious? So yeah, I mean, we've come a long way.
Yeah, if memory serves, right around 1990 when this came out, it was a real renaissance. I remember things like, you know, Boys in the Hood and Menace to Society, this, and a few other films all coming out almost right in a row, and it just really, you know, making quite a mark.
Yeah, it was a big deal because I think at that time, the biggest black film may have been Menace to Society. That made 26 or 27 million. And we came out and for a $2.5 million budget, we made 27 in the U.S., not to mention international and home video. So, but bigger than that, it was taking a classic Hollywood genre, which is sort of the teen movie, and reinventing it using cutting edge black culture. And that was sort of a revelation to Hollywood, because they were like, oh, well, wait a minute, we can understand this now. I mean, you know, it had a level of accessibility that meant a lot to Hollywood. And in those days, basically, if a black movie was successful, another black movie would get greenlit. I mean, for example, the success of the Wayans Brothers' first movie at MGM, I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, that $12 million box office meant a lot to getting our movie greenlit, because they said, well, could at least make, you know, 10 to 12 million, because that's what I'm Gonna Get You Sucker made. So, and our success helped Reject City get greenlit. So it was this kind of chain effect where either we all did well or we all did badly.
I remember going to see House Party 2 in the theater, and I didn't realize that it came out the next year. That was such a quick turnaround for that.
New Line Emmy came to us and said, okay, we want to do a sequel, but the deal was they would pay us the same money we got paid on the last one. And we were like, what? You know, and at the time, we literally were getting offers from every studio in town. But, you know, look, we wanted to make a sequel. We felt grateful for the opportunity that New Line gave us. So we're like, let's do a sequel. All you guys have to do is match the offers we're getting elsewhere. We don't want to lose money, but we want to do it. They refused. So they said, oh, we know, we got it now. I'm like, we didn't have it last time. So what ended up happening was that every sequel has made enough money to generate another sequel, but none of them have made as much money as the original.
I didn't realize that there were five House Party movies. I knew that there were three. I didn't realize, I kind of knew that there was a fourth one from seeing, the DVD for sale, you know, mm-hmm. with, all four movies. I had no idea there was a fifth one until just the other day.
They just pump them out. They just keep making money. Mm-hmm.
Between 90 and 92, you must have been so busy because Babies, Kids, and Boomerang came out in the same year.
Yeah, I was making two movies at the same time, which was pretty intense. So we were in New York shooting Boomerang, and we'd be sending notes back to the studio about Babies, Kids. And we had two movies out the same summer, which was pretty incredible.
I can't remember. How did Boomerang do?
Boomerang, it's funny. House Party is a movie that, they both are really beloved films, but for a lot of white audiences, they really aren't aware of how much more successful Boomerang was. Boomerang made $130 million all over the world, which was a huge success.
That is amazing. God, you must have been on top of the world at that point.
Yeah, it was really great. And again, the experience of working with Eddie Murphy, who was just a hero and an idol, and that amazing cast was a joy. The studio didn't 100% get the movie, and they were, you know, frustrated in a lot of ways, but the movie was very successful, and it was an interesting thing. Again, there were critics there was a famous review that called it a science fiction movie because they just couldn't believe that a black middle class existed. So they just thought the whole thing was, well, this is just some aspirational fantasy of how black life is, because they apparently had never heard of Ebony Magazine or Johnson Publications or black insurance companies or, you know, all the real life businesses that were the template for Boomerang.
Oh my God, that is crazy. Did they think that scene in House Party when they go to that more upscale party that was a fantasy as well?
You know, I never had a direct conversation with these critics, but it just really spoke to the chasm between how seemingly liberal people in the white community perceived actual black life. I mean, because the thing about House Party and Boomerang, they're not protest movies. They're not movies whining about oppression and the white man. They're just black people living their lives. I think subliminally that freaked them out because they aren't the focus of the movie. This is us living our lives and we don't give a damn about you. We're just doing our own thing. And I think that created a kind of a cognitive disconnect in their heads.
You've written a lot of live action films, but then we talked about Baby's Kids. How is it putting yourself in that role of writing an animated film? Because you get to do, I imagine, whatever you want to do because there's no concern as far as budgetary means for that.
Yeah. I mean, I love animation. I really didn't know what I was doing with Boomerang, not just because of the medium, but because I hadn't had a family yet. So I really am excited to get back into animation, family animation, because now I have kids and I've watched movies with my kids and you understand how to entertain families better once you have a family.
Well, how did you get involved with the Black Panther animated series?
Well, I wrote the Black Panther as a comic book for like 3.5-4 years. And then I got an offer to be the president of entertainment at BET, basically run the world's biggest black media company. So when I did my deal, I said, okay, I have to have a carve-out where I can keep writing my comic book. And they said, fine. And then my head of animation said, you know, we should do an adaptation of your comic book, Reggie. And I said, oh, that's a good idea. But, you know, they came back from lunch and forgot about it. And 3 months later, they had actually done this animated short, which was amazing. So I showed it to my boss. She goes, absolutely. Let's green light that. I took it to Marvel. Marvel said, we're so glad you didn't ask us permission because we would have said no, but that's great. We give the green light. So we made this animated miniseries based on my first story arc. And it was crazy because I think this is the only time in history this has ever happened that the president of a network greenlights a TV series based on a book he wrote, then you leave the network and then produce the series. So I don't think anyone's ever done all three jobs on the same thing. We did the series. But of course now I'm the old regime and, you know, the new regime comes in and they don't want to support anything with the old regime. So they didn't really promote the series. So they would just air it at midnight. But it didn't matter. Fans loved it and it became a trending topic on Twitter every night they ran it. So they ended up having to run it constantly because people loved it.
It felt like the movie picked up a lot from the series.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that run was really influential. I mean, to the Ta-Nehisi Coates run, I had sold more Black Panther comic books than anybody, including Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. And doing an animated series really broadened the audience for folks who don't read comic books, who had never heard of the character. And there were a lot of ideas that have kind of really been embraced as key parts of the Panther mythology, the importance of Wakanda as a country that's never been conquered, the invention of Shuri, never existed before, the little sister, I created her, who apparently is now everyone's favorite Disney princess. And, you know, Claw kind of being reinvented as a guy with this kind of weaponized arm. So, there was a lot of stuff from the movie, in the movie that came from the Mike run of the comic book and the and the animated series, which was very nice.
Yeah, I was showing my wife after we went to see the Black Panther movie. I was like, this is what the Claw looked like during the Secret Wars, and just that ridiculous costume that he was in.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't, like, that's the thing. When I did the book, I said, look, a lot of people, I was so excited to be working for Marvel, and I would tell my friends, hey, I'm writing the Black Panther, and they'd go, that's great, Reggie, who is that? So, the first arc was called Who is the Black Panther? And the idea is, if you had never read a comic book before, you could read these six issues and you would get the whole story about who he is. So, it just allowed me a chance to kind of create a template for what a movie might be. I mean, at the time the Marvel Cinematic Universe didn't really exist, it seemed unlikely that there would ever be a Black Panther movie, but if there were, I knew this is what it should be.
Now, I'm trying to get the timeline right, because I think Chadwick Boseman had already played the Black Panther in Civil War, maybe, and maybe something else, before you worked with him in Marshall. Is that right?
When I first met Chadwick, he had just been cast as Black Panther.
Okay.
He had not shot Civil War yet. So we met at the LACMA, the L.A. Art Museum Gala. A friend of ours, not knowing the connection, had us seated together. So we saw each other. We kind of stared at each other across the room, and he goes, I know you want to talk about it. So we just launched into this long, passionate Black Panther conversation about, you know, martial arts style and, you know, what, you know, capoeira versus jiu-jitsu and da-da-da-da and music and all these different elements. And we just kind of clicked. I just, God, he's so smart. He's so tasteful. He's so cultured. So I knew I really wanted to work with him. So when I got the Marshall script, I go, wow, there's very few people who could play Thurgood Marshall. And this guy is top of the list. So let's just go for Chadwick.
Well, I want to ask you about some of the stuff that you're working on these days. I want to know more about Blazing Samurai.
Yeah, Blazing Samurai is this animated movie that one of the executives who greenlit Boondocks, which is another animated series I've worked on, he brought it to me, and, you know, we collaborated on a little bit, you know, and I know it's in the animation process. I'm not actively working on it, but I remember there was a rough cut, and I brought my son to watch it, and so he, you know, he gave his notes. So at 10 years old, he's already putting two cents in to the movie process.
Were his notes good? Did you respect his notes?
His notes were good. He's a tough customer when it comes to movies, but very good instincts.
Well, it's got to be tough when dealing with an animated film and getting notes, because then would you have to reanimate things?
Yeah, but, you know, you do it early enough in the process that it's, you know, you're not looking at a finished film. You're looking at basically what are called animatics, which are kind of moving storyboards. So, I mean, it's actually tougher on him to watch something that crude and to be able to kind of figure out what it's going to be at the end of the day.
Well, can you tell me about Shadow Man at all?
Yeah, Shadow Man is awesome. It's based on this comic book series by Valiant, which is a really great comic book company. I love those characters from the time they launched. So my friend Sean Daniels got the rights to produce Shadow Man. So I called him immediately and said, that is my book. You got to give me that movie. And he says, we're on it, Reggie. So I've been working with Adam Simon, who's an amazing writer, and is waiting on the next draft of the script. I mean, we brainstormed so many fantastic ideas. So it's literally, we're just editing it down. Like, okay, we're going to put the whole kitchen sink in this movie. And so we got to slice the pieces pretty thin. But, you know, I love superhero movies. I've seen them all. So the challenge is, how do you show something that you haven't seen in these movies before? How do you break new ground? So that's what's exciting about it.
Were you a big comic book reader when you were growing up?
Absolutely. I still maintain sort of a family comic book collection, which is this thousands and thousands of comics. I think, It may be 50,000. I don't know the exact number, but it's a storage problem.
Were you more of a DC or a Marvel kid?
I really was totally broad. Marvel, DC, Gold Key, Harvey, Archie. I just loved the medium. I just read everything that was in a comic book.
When was Black Panther a thing? What age were you when that became a real thing? Was that late 60s?
Black Panther debuted in 1966. And what's crazy is, so you got two great Jewish geniuses, Stanley and Jack Kirby, who come up with the idea of a superhero named Black Panther. Then you've got two geniuses in Oakland who come up with the idea of the Black Panther Party. So it happened at the same time in the same year with a whole country between them, but just brilliant ideas.
Mr. Hudlin, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a real pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thank you, man. It's been fun. Absolutely.
Brothers, I can hunt a boat face!
I want to thank all of you for making it possible for me to go to college. I won't let you down.
Your tuition check bounced.
My tuition check bounced?
Wake up!
Get out of my room.
Yo, without even hearing my plan. Sigh! A house party.
House party?
The mother of house parties, man. A pajama jammy jam. All proceeds going to the Christopher Robinson Scholarship Fund.
Give it up, Black. What's going on, man? Name Jamal.
Do me a favor.
What?
Talk white.
Love the rap.
Everybody know about this part, but the three of you.
I know, Grandma. What up with that?
Oh, baby.
I want to move. What up with that?
You look good.
Kid and Play. Full Force. Tisha Campbell. Iman. Queen Latifah. And Martin Lawrence. It's the slamminest party ever. House Party 2.
All right, we're back and we're talking about House Party. House Party, which was very successful. And of course, since that happened, there has to be a sequel. And in this case, there has to be multiple sequels. So you talked about how it felt like Kid and Play were in college when it came to House Party 1, Jay, and with House Party 2, I can't say they are in college, but definitely Kid is in college, which is a little bit more fitting with, I think he was like 27 or so when they were making these movies, 26, 27. So it fits a little bit better with his age. He's still not college age, but we're getting a little closer here with this. And this one is another one where Play is, I mean, he is really a dick in this. And just the way that we have him taking Kid's money for college and spending it and basically losing it to Iman, who is playing a scam artist. I mean, he's really not very nice at all.
No, he's an awful friend. When you really think about it in retrospect, he's a terrible friend. He's one of those guys where it's that you would almost, it almost makes you wonder how on earth do they maintain any kind of friendship along the way that he would treat him. And it was like watching this movie, it was almost like they were trying to figure out what to do when you had a really good first movie. And obviously one of the main things is this is also the tribute to Robin Harris along the way too, and seeing them kind of redevelop over time. It was different. I mean, it's obviously a year and a half later than when the movie comes out. And I do wonder how they were able to maintain that friendship, because you take that much money from me, I'm not going to be the nicest guy to deal with.
$10,000? Yeah. That's fucking crazy. I can't say that I'd like House Party 2 that much. And especially, I was talking about the structure of the first House Party and how the House Party is the entire second act. And in this one, the House Party is basically the third act. So we're building up the entire time. And there's no even mention of a House Party. And frankly, not to be a nitpicker, but technically they're not having a house party because this doesn't take place in a house. but But to have the, and I love when Play says the pajama jammy jam, having that at the end of this, it's all building up to that. And that's where all of these parties come together and we have everything happening. The one line now, talking about watching these movies almost 30 years later, the line that really cracks me up is the whole idea of Sydney and her new roommate, who's played by Queen Latifah. And when Sydney has to ask her point blank, "You do like boys, don't you?"
Another thing that's dated very well.
Well, the early 90s again, were we always thought the 90s were a lot more progressive than they actually were. Wow. When I heard her say that, I couldn't help but cringe. It was kind of the uncomfortable laughter.
You know, as we're talking about the first movie, I'm thinking of other movies that were happening around the same time. You know, we're talking about the way that the cops are harassing kids, and I'm just like, yeah, this is very light compared to something like a Boys in the Hood or Menace to Society, where you really get to see that stuff. And with this one, with them happening at college, I'm just like, what year is School Days coming out? You know, because that really speaks to cultural identity and those kind of things. And that's kind of what Queen Latifah is bringing to it, and the way that she's dressing in more traditional garb and all this, and the way that Sydney is trying to figure herself out. And that's one thing I like about this movie, is the idea of going to college and trying to figure out who you are. And that's kind of a nice thing. I don't know if it's 100% successful, but it happens in this. And again, these characters are charming enough that I want to see the continuing adventures of them. What they end up doing, I'm like, okay, you know, I'm not that excited. And, you know, I cringe when Iman is on screen and I'm just like, she's a scam artist. Why can't you see that? But now, Patrick, had you seen this one before, or was this new for you?
This was new for me, and it was, and it's kind of that thing where this happens, unfortunately, with a lot of sequels. I liked it okay. Like you said, I liked the characters and the actors enough that I had an okay time with it. But it is kind of that thing where, you know, sometimes when there's a movie that comes out and it's, hey, that was surprisingly good, that could have been so much worse, and instead they made it something special. And then the sequel comes along and it's like, oh, this is the movie that the first movie could have been, you know, had they not put more care into it. I was excited when Rusty Cundiff's name came up as a writer. I feel like the first House Party, if you are talking to somebody you just met and you know, the movie House Party comes up, both of you are going to be like, oh man, House Party. Yeah, that movie's really, really cool. I really like that movie. And House Party 2, I feel like its only cultural relevancy is the phrase pajama jammy jam. That has carried on to this day. But other than that, I will remember very little about House Party 2.
Now, on the other hand, House Party 3, I love House Party 3. And I think the reason why I love it so much is Bernie Mac. Because I could give a shit about Immature, the new band that they're introducing, and I don't know what it was with the 90s and having to have like little kid versions of bands. That's a weird fucking thing. I don't know if it still goes on today, but like back when like Crisscross was happening, I mean, I remember Menudo, of course, you know, it's just like, yeah, we're going to take little kids and put them into bands and won't that be cute? And so when you have these like really over sexualized, we want to drink and drug and do all this kind of stuff, more drinking, I suppose, is their thing. You know, we're going to take over the party and blah, 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 blah. Like, the Immature parts, I really don't give a shit about that at all. But the parts with Bernie Mac, fucking hilarious. As soon as he comes on screen, and I think he comes on way too late, but as soon as he comes on, he is electrifying. And all the parts with him are some of the things that I still quote from today. The typical scene of the more high-class people having dinner with the lower-class people, and then Bernie Mac.
Now I remember. I even remember your name. They should call you Jawbone. Wow.
It was so interesting because, yeah, this movie came out in 94, and this was around that obviously the Crisscross is trying to make their comeback, and now you're getting into groups like TLC, and that was a part of that weird little stretch. Another one was another Bad Creation was another kid group of the early 90s that was, they were actually kind of a rival to Crisscross, which is really funny. But it is different, because I didn't, admittedly, I wasn't as big a fan of this one, because I think, and obviously they knew, like, this was kind of the end of the road for House Party, because you could only do three. It was just like, there's really all you could do is three of these. Bernie Mac is a Bernie Mac was a national treasure. It still hurts. And plus, Chris Tucker also showed up in this film, too, which I'd forgotten about, that this was before Friday that Chris Tucker showed up in one of these movies. And this movie had its high points, Bernie Mac being the biggest high point of it all, where if you were going to have a guy kind of fill that Robin Harris spot, there's no better person to fill it than a guy like Bernie Mac, who Robin Harris was one of the guys he was inspired by. So it makes total sense to have him in there. It was, by and large, I mean, of the three, I like three better than two. Nothing was going to touch the first one, but I like three better than two. Again, it was like almost like a time capsule of what hip-hop culture was when you got to the mid-1990s. So by this point, I was in high school. So when you're to the mid-1990s now, and you're seeing where the game is and how culture really is and where that's going.
There are weird moments in this movie, very surrealistic moments, like the three blind rappers that, and I didn't even realize that they were blind until after the show, and Play's trying to give them like dollar bills instead of a $100 bill, and them getting out into their car, and two guys are driving, the third guy has a long pole and is using that to help them drive. Again, not very PC whatsoever. Almost felt like that was coming out of one of the Wayans Brothers movies. But okay, but the ex-con catering, again, it's a weird moment because the whole thing looks like prison. They're behind bars when they're taking their orders and everything. But those two guys and the chemistry they have, and when the one guy just starts ripping on basically the Belial stand-in in this one, I think his name is Stinky, when he starts ripping on Stinky.
First of all, you need to calm the fuck down and go gargle. Funky.
Man, my name is Stinky. Stinky, all right?
Stinky, Funky, smell hella bad. It's all the same.
Fuck all of that. Nigga, your name is Funky because you come up in here smelling like butt crack now.
Yo, squash all that, man. All I'm talking about, the food better be on. You hear what I'm saying? Oh, look at this nigga. Mr. Baller. Mr. High Roller. Mr. Flashy fucking money. What's this? You got it like that, punk? Pay a nigga now.
You got my food now? Or maybe, do you have my food now?
Fuck all the dumb shit. Let me tell you something. You don't come in this motherfucker making no goddamn demands. Nigga, fuck around, throw your punk ass on the grill.
Straight make some barbecue, bitch.
No, fuck all that. Nigga, bake all three of they punk ass and make three bits pie now.
Movies like this were always great for one-liners and things that you can remember that really stand out. And there were, and it was like a part of a series of movies at that point in the 90s, where you ran through movies like CB4 and the House Party movies, and later down the line you had the first Friday movie. They all had the Wayans movies always had these great one-liners in them that always stuck with you, where even if you couldn't remember everything about the film, you remembered the three bitch pie, or go eat your big ass biscuit, or you got knocked the fuck out. It's like there's always something that jumps out to you and it takes you back there, because I mean, no one will ever say some of these movies were some of the greatest in terms of aesthetically or anything else like that. But just in terms of creativity and in terms of what people can say and how some of these things were written, they are fantastic in that aspect, because they made that long lasting impression on you. And plus, they were just damn funny. And a lot of that is just that they're funny. And I think that's why they stuck with me and so many others for so long, is they had those high points and those moments.
I was surprised because the woman that plays the aunt, who, I mean, we've had characters like this in so many movies where it's the dimensional aunt who doesn't really know what's going on. You can tell her one thing and, you know, just pull the wool over her eyes the whole time. You know, there's the moment in here where she's watching a porn tape, and then meanwhile back at the bachelor party they're watching what she was supposed to be watching. That is Ketty Lester, and I never knew that she was an actress. I only knew of her from her music work, and I only knew of her from her song Love Letters, which is where we get the great line in Blue Velvet of, you know, I'm going to send you a love letter straight from my fucking heart. So I've heard her sing so many times, and I never put the two things together until I was watching it this last time and said, Ketty Lester, why do I know that name? And I had to go look it up. But she was great. I love her in this movie, and that she is that dimensional older character role, but it works in this movie. And I like when she and Bernie Mac are on screen at the same time and doing kind of a back and forth with that, and that Bernie Mac knows that she's crazy and just has no problems telling her that, basically to her face.
That was a part of the greatness that he had. And seeing them kind of play off of each other too was really, really cool. And it was interesting to see her in a film like, especially that type of film. Because obviously at the time, this was 1994, and I had this, so she was 60, I think she was 60 years old when she did this. And she's standing, understand, she's still alive. But she's 64 years old, or 60 years old in a movie like that, and yet she played a role in it that stuck out, that didn't feel like she was out of place in there. It was almost like a nod again to music's past and kind of bridging it between past and present.
So did you guys get a chance to watch House Party 4 and 5?
I did not. I have not seen. I've only heard about those. I have not seen them.
I didn't even know that House Party 5 existed until I started doing research for this film. And, I mean, there is a huge gap of time between, well, so yeah, you said House Party 3, 1994, the first one's in 90, second one's in 91. In there, we've got Class Act, which I also really like. I don't think it can really hold that much of a candle to the first House Party film, but I still enjoy it. House Party 4 was 2001, so a little bit more of a gap between those. And then House Party 5, which doesn't call itself House Party 5, it just calls itself House Party, colon, Tonight's the Night, 2013. So we are 23 years out from the original House Party, and apparently Kid and Play make appearances in these other two movies. I never made it to their parts because I had to turn these things off because, oh my God, we are in a post-American Pie world by the time that fourth one comes out, and you can tell. And both of these films have the production values of one of those, like, quickie God's Not Dead Christian movies. They just feel, it's like Lifetime feels like it has more of production value than either one of these movies.
No, I honestly, I couldn't do it. I remember just seeing a preview or something of what would be House Party 5, and I just said, hell no, not doing this. It's just cannot do it. It's that's how you know it tarnishes the memory of the, like, Robin Harris is rolling over in his grave at the thought of a House Party 5.
House Party 4 felt like sub-tier Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Like, it starts with one of the guys, and I think he's one of the guys from Immature, and by that time, I think they're calling themselves, like, IMZ.
Correction. Immature became IMX, not IMZ.
Because they are much older by this point. And it starts with him pretending that he's sick and so that he can get out of going on whatever trip it is and then end up going over to his uncle's place maybe and watching the house, and then that's where the house party takes place. And talking about that whole idea of we have to clean up the house before the parents get back that we didn't have in House Party 1, that's fully in force with House Party 4. And it's just like, oh, you got to be kidding me. And then I made it through maybe 15 minutes of that movie, and the amount of times that our main character turns and talks to the camera, oh man. And I watched the last few minutes of the film, and it ends with them looking at the camera and talking to the audience. It's just like, no, no, no. And then the fifth movie, I started watching that, and there was like a video conference call because there's one of the two main characters in that movie is a white dude, which just was really offensive to me. I love how they make fun of the white dude in the second movie, you know, Jamal. But yeah, it's like they're on a video conference call, and the one kid's dad comes in and he starts bad-mouthing the white dude, and the look of the video conferencing technology, it just is like, oh, he's talking to a green screen and there's this kid placed over this computer screen. It just looks so cheap that I was like, no, I can't do it. I really cannot do this.
Yeah, I see that it's directed by Darren Scott, and I really like Darren Scott, but his name as a director does not often signify a movie with much of a budget or of particularly high quality.
I tried like crazy to see the 83 short that the first House Party was based on, and I could not find that anywhere. And, you know, we were talking about outtakes and stuff before. I wish that there was some sort of a deluxe version of the first House Party film that had the short, that had the outtakes, that had all that kind of stuff, because I would love to see that because, and I think, and I'm not trying to be facetious, and I think by now, you know, after talking about this for an hour, people will realize that I'm not being facetious. I think this movie deserves that. I think it needs to have more respect and more of a, you know, attention paid to it as far as being this really memorable time capsule from the 80s and have all those things in there because I would like to know more of the making of this film. And again, you know, the cultural importance of Kid and Play as these, you know, artists. And I love that they have this backstory of them being Salt-N-Pepa's backup dancers, but then being popular enough in their own right and being talented enough in their own right to have the spotlight on them. That's fantastic.
It would be great to see it too. Just to, if for no other reason is that to find out that this, that House Party started out as a student film at Harvard and just to see the development of how it became a part of this, what really was like a cultural, kind of a cultural phenomenon. It was part of that wave in the late 80s and early 90s of black cinema. And it started as a Harvard student film. I'd love to see how that thing kind of transferred over and how much of that and how it kind of evolved into what became the first House Party and eventually to House Party 5, but so, the first one more so than anything else.
Kid and Play were so popular at one point that, and it was right around the time that this movie came out, there was a Kid and Play animated series.
Oh, I remember it.
I remember that too.
These guys, they were on top of the world for a while, and it's just amazing that they had that much clout, and I love it.
No, they were really, really big. It's almost kind of forgotten that they were right there in the early 90s with DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, and with, well, and nobody was bigger than MC Hammer for those 2 years, but those guys were right in that conversation. They really were. I remember the Kid and Play cartoon. It was kind of stunning, actually, how big they were. It was just that they kind of flamed out pretty quickly, like almost everything did in the early 90s. But they had something going there for a little while, and House Party really helped enhance it, which, again, is really hilarious when you think of how raunchy House Party was that they were able to then turn them into a kid show and get them over. But that's... that was more on the personality and their draw.
Well, heck, they had a cartoon made out of Rambo, so.
I do think that's why I remember the movie being softer, though, because they were, you know, a cartoon series, and I felt like they were like a more family-friendly hip-hop duo. And then I see the movie, and it's like, oh, no, no, this is definitely an R-rated movie.
You were saying what people came out of these films. I mean, obviously, you know, Martin Lawrence, by the time the third movie came around, he wasn't available because he's already doing Martin, which ends up springboarding him onto bigger and better things as well. Bernie Mac, this was one of his first appearances, if memory serves, and then he, you know, was got very huge as well, was showing up in everything. Again, I don't think that he ever got the attention and respect that he necessarily deserved. I always felt that he should have been the top banana instead of being like the second, third, fourth banana. Like when he would show up in things like Charlie's Angels, was it Charlie's Angels 2 or the, yeah, might have been in the first one.
He was the second one, yeah.
Okay, shows up in Charlie's Angels 2 or he shows up in the Transformers film, you know, these kind of things. He just always brought such a bright point to it, and to me, he was my favorite Ocean of all the Ocean's 11s. So
I remember going to see the original Kings of Comedy, I think the day it opened. And he was not totally on my radar at that time. He might have been the one I was least familiar with. And he goes last. And I just remember him just wiping the stage with everyone who came before him.
Incredible.
His set just kills. He is so great in that movie, and that made me a fan of his for life.
Around that time in the early 90s, this is when Russell Simmons' Def Comedy Jam was still on HBO. And that's where the first time I had seen Bernie Mac, where all I needed to know was the first time I saw him, the first words he says was, "I ain't scared of you motherfuckers." And it was from that point on, he had me. And Bernie didn't really – the sad thing is he didn't really start getting his due until the year he died. It was because he died in 2008. It was to about late 06 to when he died in 08. That's when he was really starting to truly shine. And then he got sick and he was gone almost in a flash. He was such an amazing comedian with unbelievable timing. It was the Kings of Comedy thing. I don't often go to see movies more than once in theater, But I remember that summer Kings of Comedy came out. I must have gone to see it 3 or 4 times. And it was specifically for Bernie's set at the end, where he was just magnificent. And he was almost like he could have been like a comedic version of Samuel L. Jackson, is where I could eventually see him being. Is like a Samuel L. Jackson type of guy who can be, he can be himself in every movie, yet be a distinctive character in every movie. And it works itself out perfectly. But unfortunately, we lost him way too soon.
Yeah, that was one where I didn't even know he was sick. And it was just like, oh, Bernie Mac passed away. It's like, what? You got to be fucking kidding me. I mean, it felt like I had just seen him in Ocean's 13 and Transformers. And yeah, that was a few years before he passed, but it just felt like he was always there. He was always a presence. And then his TV show was on for, what, at least like 5 years? So he was around. He was there. And then all of a sudden he wasn't there. And it was just, I couldn't believe it, because he just always had that energy and the vivaciousness. And like, he is uncontrolled when he comes to House Party 3. He is just such a manic energy that is brought into that movie, which I think that was sorely lacking. So when he finally shows up, it's just like, yeah, now we're talking.
Absolutely. His energy always entered the room before he did. And it varied from movie to movie. When I remember him being in Don't Be a Menace, and he plays the police officer character, and he's playing this angry, racist, yet he's black police officer, and he's telling Marlon and Sean that I hate your black skin. I hate black pepper. I hate my gums because they're black. And you just can't stop laughing at some of the things he says, where you can almost see people in the background trying to keep it together, because that's how funny he was. And he could, his facial expressions, where he goes from that to when he was in the movie Friday and he's playing the lecherous preacher. And there's so many of these things where it was the Sam Jackson comparison, maybe the best one, because Sam Jackson, so many of his characters are so distinctively Samuel L. Jackson, but yet they fit in each place that he is. And that's how Bernie fit in the Oceans movies. Was the same way, that you know this is Bernie Mac, but it works. And it works across time periods and everything else. And there were so many stars that came from those movies of the early 90s, but Bernie Mac was almost kind of a forgotten gem at times, which is really, again, it's sad that we lost him when we did, because I guess he would barely be into his 60s now if he were alive. But we lost him a little bit too soon. And I was in Chicago the day that he passed away. He's from Chicago. And I was in Chicago the day he passed away, and I remember, because they interrupted like TV programming out there. That he was one of Chicago's native sons, that they legitimately mourned out there when he died. It was tough, because that guy was so good and so funny and so distinctive, that to have a character like him, there are so many movies even now, movies and TV shows now, that could use a guy like Bernie Mac, even at what he would be in terms of his age today.
Yeah, I'm very curious, because I keep reading that LeBron James is going to try to reboot the series. I hope that they won't do part 6, and that'll be kind of a new thing that he's doing. And who would be that type of character? You know, who is that Robin Harris? Who is that Bernie Mac today? Or are we just going to forego that and do our own thing? I'm just curious to see what he does with it. I'm, you know, after 4 and 5, there's no place to go but up. All right, if you guys are good, we're going to take another break and play a preview for next week's show.
It was like I caught a skating fever or something. You know, I didn't even come home that night. I sat there amazed by all the skaters and all the music and all the power and all the energy in the rink. And the next morning, I went and bought me some skates, and I've been skating ever since.
Go into a fit. anything, the Muhammad Ali of roller skating.
Some way, somehow, that I can just skate my way out of Bedford Stuyvesant.
I don't even eat no more. I don't even sleep no more. All I do is disco rollers. I love it. I really do.
That's right. We'll be back next week with a discussion of Get Rollin'. So get your roller skates on. And until then, I want to thank this week's co-hosts, Jay and Patrick. So, Patrick, what is the latest with you, sir?
I am podcasting every week and writing every day at fthismovie.com.
Short and sweet. I love it. And Jay, what's been keeping you busy lately?
Well, I teach journalism and editing courses at Lincoln University out here near Philadelphia, but I've also been hosting my own podcast. It's called JSC Radio. Up to 92nd episode will be coming, excuse me, the 93rd episode will be coming very soon, actually going to be coming this week. My show is a little bit of everything. Started off as a sports show, but we hit just about everything you can think of, including movies and a lot. Well, I'm Super Bowl coming up, so I'll be doing a lot of that this week as well. So I can be reached on Twitter at Jay Scott Smith. That's J-A-Y-S-C-O, two T's, S-M-I-T-H. Same for Instagram. And you can also follow my show, JSC Radio, on Twitter at JSC Radio, as well as on Patreon, patreon.com/JSC Radio. Let's help this thing keep growing. I appreciate this.
Well, it has been a real pleasure talking with you guys. Thanks for being on the show. Thanks to everybody for listening. Please head on over to the website projection-boot.com where you can find out more about today's episode. You'll also find links over to iTunes where you can rate and review the show, and to Patreon where you can make a donation to our show as well as Jay's show. And I think even F This Movies might have a Patreon as well.
Not yet, but we probably should.
Okay, maybe by the time this comes out. Yeah. Patrick's got to eat. Donors get early access to every episode as long as I'm not running late. Every donation and every rating we get helps the projection booth take over the world.
You cook good? Can you read or is your brain like wood? Do you have sex or do you make love? How do you live? Do you give it? Do you take love? Girl, you're so fine. Could you be mine? Or do I slack in the back of a wig with whack line? Yeah, the food looks right, but that pops up fine. Yeah, right. At your age, not the size of those hands. of supply and demand. A girl without a mind ain't human. There gotta be more than just a butt that's booming. Assuming there's room in my life for a lover undercover, not the one that'll hover over me like a bird. The force says, I ain't with that. Yes, girl, you better kick that.
And play. Now everybody sing. Now we're the stars of stage, wax, and video.
We're here to tear it up, so come on, here we go.
Pump it up, this is high-powered stuff.
Can't play, can't get enough
of that fun. Go, go, go rhythm.
You wanted a dope jam?
Well, that's what we're giving.
We're headed for fame,
because Kid and Play's driven.
Boy, we know game.
And large is how we're living.
We stay paid.
You know the boys have got it made.
See, I'm the tramp.
And I'm the fella with the high top fade.
Get down to the sound.
You know we're about to turn it out. Roll with Kid and Play. Everybody shout.
Shake it down. We got the best music all around.
Hurts the producer, wins
play. Now everybody say,
if you enjoy this show and want more people to know about it, head on over to iTunes, leave a comment, and rate it 5 stars. Make sure you like and share us on Facebook, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Just search for Christopher Media. Thank you in advance for supporting Christopher Media by clicking on the PayPal button and by clicking through to all the sponsors who support ChristopherMedia.net. Most importantly, we would like to take the time to extend an extra special thanks to you. Christopher Media could not exist without your support. Thank you for visiting ChristopherMedia.net, and thank you for listening. Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.
I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. We've created a new way to protect you from unpredictable interest rates. Our exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, we lock your interest rate for up to 90 days. Then, if rates go up, your rate stays locked. But if rates go down, your rate drops. Either way, you win. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year fixed-rate loans. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply.
I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. We've created a new way to protect you from unpredictable interest rates. Our exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, we lock your interest rate for up to 90 days. Then, if rates go up, your rate stays locked. But if rates go down, your rate drops. Either way, you win. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year fixed-rate loans. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply.